So very happy to welcome Betsy Kasdan, independent scholar from Rhode Island, author of the recent chapter Quakers, Slavery, Anti-Slavery and Race in the Oxford Handbook of Quaker Studies, who's going to talk to us today about slave rebellions and Quaker anxiety in the turn against slavery.
My research, which is on Quakers and slavery, starts with the observation of David Bryan Davis and others that it is not slavery that requires explanation, but rather the intellectual and then political turn against slavery. In the Quaker Atlantic, that turn took institutional form between about 1755 and 1770, although obviously with stirrings long before that. So where did that come from? We tend to have this image of John Woolman sitting quietly in his rural New Jersey meeting house, and this voice says, "Slavery is wrong." And then he and Anthony Benezet tell everyone else, and it's done, and then Quakers tell the world. Various scholars have found a little more complicated intellectual roots of Quaker anti-slavery in the insistence that all humans were of one blood and all had access to grace, in rising reformist concerns about laziness, luxury, and other sins, and in uneasiness with the violence of the slave system. All of those are factors, although, as I argued here 3 years ago, 18th century friends did not exactly have a testimony of equality in the 21st century sense. What I'm arguing here is that fear of slave insurrections was an additional factor that has not received adequate attention. Quaker anti-slavery discourse comes in distinct waves, with a flurry of tracts, minutes, and epistles for a few years, and then the concern seems to die down for 10 or 15 years before it rises again. Some of that is because people who spoke out got disowned or otherwise silenced, but I've long suspected that there was a deeper cycle at work. Several years ago, I heard a talk by a young scholar about slave insurrections, noting that they also come in waves, building to a peak and then subsiding for a while before the next wave. The scholar Jason Sharples had actually graphed the waves through the 18th century, and I noticed that the peaks and troughs pretty much matched the peaks and troughs of Quaker discourse. So I began to explore that perhaps this was not coincidental. This paper is a tentative exploration of those links, and I would welcome your questions, comments, and critiques. After some preliminary comments about slave insurrections, this paper looks at three periods in which Quaker discourse was influenced by the fear of slave rebellions: the Caribbean in the 1670s and 80s, the Philadelphia area in the 1690s and then into the early 1700s, and then the entire Quaker Atlantic in the 1730s and 40s. And then some closing remarks on why I think this matters. To some extent, people throughout the British Atlantic always lived with the fear and risk of rebellions. And the closest parallel to me is thinking about our current preoccupation in both this country and in the US with terrorist attacks. The standard nightmare scenario was that slaves acting in concert would kill as many whites as possible, perhaps pausing first to rape the women, burn down all the buildings, and take over the colony. There were enough insurrections on ships transporting enslaved Africans across the Atlantic that ships and procedures were designed specifically to lower that risk. Every colony with plantation slavery developed elaborate regulations and security measures designed to prevent organized insurrections. Ironically, it's been suggested that people like Quakers or Garrisonian abolitionists, who see blacks as essentially equal to whites, are more fearful of slave revolts. If you think that blacks are inherently docile, stupid, and lazy, there's little to fear. But if you see them as people essentially like yourself, with resentments, desires, skills, and capacity to carry out complex schemes, there's a lot to be afraid of. Fear of conspiracies may also have a bit more bite when your theology teaches that nothing happens by accident. Every event shows either the hand of God or the work of the devil. It's also worth noting that news traveled through the British Atlantic relatively efficiently, so that revolts in the Caribbean or in South Carolina would be reported within a couple of weeks, not necessarily accurately, but at least quickly, in newspapers of Philadelphia, New York, Boston, London, Bristol, and so on. So this is the context in which Quakers lived and moved, as merchants, as plantation owners, as farmers or shopkeepers. So let's begin in the Sugar Islands of the British Caribbean, where Quakers first encountered the challenges and contradictions in the system of African slavery, and where there was a very real risk of slave revolts. For both merchants and evangelists, the easy route from England to America runs south to the Azores and then west to the islands, usually to Barbados. The island was relatively flat, not unbearably hot, with fertile soil and adequate rainfall. The first English colonists grew tobacco using white indentured labor, mostly Irish, and the Irish workers actually rebelled twice in the 1630s and 40s. But Barbados could not compete with better quality Virginia tobacco, so by the 1640s, planters moved to sugar cane as the major cash crop and African slaves as the workers. The first Quaker evangelists, Mary Fisher and Anne Austin, arrived in Barbados in 1655, neatly the same year that Admiral Penn captured Jamaica from Spain. They quickly convinced a number of planters, including John Rouse, who would later marry Margaret Fell's daughter. By the 1670s, Barbados was one of England's wealthiest colonies, and enslaved Africans outnumbered white settlers by at least 3-2. As that majority tipping point passed, the fear of slave insurrection increased. Like other slave societies, Barbados tried to keep the threat down and the profits up through an increasingly repressive and brutal regime. Slave codes gave planters almost unlimited rights to punish slaves through beatings, mutilation, and summary execution. The Governing Council also established a strong militia, requiring planters to provide both men and horses proportional to the size of their plantations, something that obviously would be a problem for Friends. George Fox's visit to Barbados in 1671 produced two significant texts, a sermon published as Gospel Family Order and a letter to the governor, authorities, and Anglican clergy. I'm not going to attempt a thorough discussion of those texts in the time we have here. It's been done quite adequately elsewhere. In brief, the Barbados plantocracy and the Anglican clergy accused Quakers of inciting slaves to rebel by meeting with them and preaching to them. In both tracts, but especially in the letter to the governor, Fox directly addressed this, quote, slander and lie they have cast upon us, namely that we should teach the Negroes to rebel. Fox did not minimize or disagree with the planters' fear of slave insurrections and the need to prevent them. On the contrary, he said, teaching the slaves to rebel is, quote, a thing we do utterly abhor and detest in and from our hearts. Where Friends disagreed was on the best way to avoid rebellions. Instead of brutality, Fox argued, the Christian planter should treat his slaves well and preach to them the gospel of peace. To exhort and admonish them, Fox wrote, to be sober and to fear God, to love their masters and mistresses, and to be faithful and diligent in their master's service and business. Fox's visit was followed in 1675 by a return visit from Irish minister William Edmondson. A few months before he arrived, Barbados officials uncovered a slave plot to kill all the whites and burn the sugar fields. The militia rounded up dozens of suspects and special courts-martial ordered more than 40 slaves executed. When Edmondson arrived, he faced accusations that he was actually an Irish Jesuit sent to incite further rebellion. Remember, the Irish have rebelled as well as the Negroes rebelling. Like Fox, Edmondson defended Quaker practice by arguing that Negroes who had been evangelized would be less likely to rebel. The 1675 rebellion also intensified the conflict between Quakers and the Barbadian authorities over participation in the militia. The militia was not only for defense against French or Spanish invasion. It was a key component of the system for controlling the enslaved population, patrolling the countryside, searching slave quarters, detaining and beating slaves, and breaking up gatherings that might be plotting. For Quakers, however, the question of armed patrols fit within ongoing debates about Quaker use of carnal weapons or cooperation with those who did. Could Quaker merchants have guns on their ships or travel in patrols with those who did, for example? Barbados friends offered to ride unarmed with the patrols. In an epistle to friends in Nevis, Fox commended that policy. He discussed biblical texts saying that magistrates are put there by God to maintain good order for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of them that do well, and that friends therefore were required to cooperate with them, except when conscience dictated otherwise. So Fox said, if any should come to burn your house or rob you or ravish your wives and daughters, or a company should come to fire a city or town or to kill people, it was friends' duties to, quote, watch against such evil things, though in their own way, which is to say unarmed, and to report them to the magistrates so that evildoers could be punished. It was an uneasy compromise and one that sparked bitter opposition. One critic commented that friends in England and the islands were obviously happy to enjoy the profits of sugar plantations, but their policy on militia service amounted to, quote, never striking even a dog, but having no objection to cry out, mad dog, and let another kill him. Before we move north to Philadelphia, it's worth noting that there were additional large slave uprisings in Barbados in 1686 and 1692, and in between in Antigua, Jamaica, and Virginia. The Caribbean experience resonated among friends further north. The now famous Germantown protest of 1688 asked rhetorically, and I'm excerpting here, if these slaves should join themselves, fight for their freedom, and handle their masters and mistresses as they did handle them before, will the masters and mistresses take the sword at hand and war against these poor slaves, as we're able to believe some will not refuse to do? In other words, the golden rule was not merely divine command, it was practical, prudent advice. Do unto others, lest they do unto you. 10 years later, after a few more rebellions, Philadelphia friend Robert Pyle worried that slaves might rise in rebellion and do us much mischief, except we keep a militia which is against our principles, recognizing the link between friends' policy on the militia and the slave system. Fearful whites understood that the number and ratio of enslaved Africans affected the risk of rebellions. In 1698, just as Pyle was writing, the South Carolina Assembly encouraged the import of white servants, observing that the great number of Negroes which have been late imported into this colony may endanger the safety thereof. Philadelphia friends also feared the increasing number of Africans brought into Pennsylvania. And I won't go through all the detail, but there's a series of minutes about not encouraging imports. So Philadelphia Monthly Meeting wrote to the meeting in Barbados, begging them not to send any more slaves, expressing, quote, the sense of our yearly meeting that many Negroes in these parts may prove prejudicial several ways to us and our posterity. all of these minutes through to 1720 do not focus on the transatlantic slave trade, but only on whether the slaves ended up in Pennsylvania rather than in the Sugar Islands. The Pennsylvania Assembly then tried to impose import duties to restrict numbers. The Privy Council kept striking them down. Eventually, in 1711, friends in Chester Quarter brought the matter back to the yearly meeting, which reiterated its earlier advice about restricting imports. New England Yearly Meeting in 1716 issued a similar minute asking friends to try and discourage their correspondents in the islands from sending any more Negroes north, but not addressing New England friends' growing involvement in the transatlantic trade. That wave of minutes in 1711 to 1719 coincided with a new wave of slave insurrections in Virginia, in New York City, in South Carolina. In New York, in 1712, enslaved Africans set fire to a couple of buildings and then killed 9 whites. 70 people were arrested, of whom 21 were convicted and executed, 20 by burning and 1 on the breaking wheel. Ugh. In 1712, Pennsylvania friends asked London for advice on the imports question. And London did say that it was the sense of the yearly meeting that importing them is not a commendable nor allowed practice. London, like the Philadelphia minutes, noted that the multiplying of Negro slaves among you may be of dangerous consequences considering the peaceable principle we profess. In other words, the risk of slave uprisings and the challenge of how to suppress them without using the unacceptable militia was a significant factor in the concerns about slavery on both sides of the Atlantic. Fear of insurrections was, of course, not the only thing motivating friends to reconsider their stance on slavery. John Hepburn's 1715 tract, for example, warns that God will punish slave owners who refuse to free their slaves. But the wording implies that he's thinking of eternal damnation, not of arson destroying your cow barn tomorrow. After 1719, the Quaker discourse goes quiet again for 10 or 15 years, and when it picks up, it's both more extensive and more complicated than in the earlier periods. I'd just like to sketch out a few pieces of that very complicated period. During the 1730s, the number of Africans brought into the North American colonies quadrupled. With that increase came a new wave of slave uprisings, some quite extensive, throughout the British Atlantic. In late 1733, there were reports in the Boston newspapers that blacks on the island of St. John's had killed virtually every white inhabitant, some 200 families. That was followed by a similar uprising on St. Kitts. Within 2 months, there was a conspiracy discovered, unclear how real, in New Jersey. Same scenario, cut all the throats, burn all the buildings. Later in 1734, there was a partially successful uprising in Jamaica, where there was then a Maroon community living somewhat independently, and it became a refuge to which other slaves fled. 18 months later, a large plot in Antigua involving more than 400 blacks. The next few years saw a large conspiracy in Stono, South Carolina, a smaller one in Maryland, and a rather large one in New York City. This is 1741. That resulted in burning or hanging of 30 blacks and 4 whites. In the summer of 1737, in the middle of this, a black confessed to setting fire to a house owned by James Logan, clerk of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting and acting governor of the colony. This is the context in which I read, for example, the 1740 minute of Virginia Yearly Meeting, reaffirming that Quakers should not serve on armed patrols to keep slaves from running about in the night. It also frames an epistle written by English minister John Bell in 1741 and distributed widely in the colonies, in which he warns that if friends persist in slave owning and particularly in cruelty towards slaves, quote, then shall the blood of your posterity be required at your hands. The slave uprisings also, I think, put a questionable spin on the famous incident in which Benjamin Lay, in the sessions of the yearly meeting, tears off his Quaker clothes to reveal a military uniform complete with sword, takes the sword, and strikes probably a pig bladder full of some kind of red fluid, denouncing slavery and slaveholders. It's often been read as referring to the violence inherent in the slave trafficking. But Lay had lived in Barbados for about 10 years and was himself accused of inciting rebellion. And I wonder whether the bloody pig bladder may also have invoked those underlying pre-existing fears that continuing the slave system would put white lives at risk. Historian Herb Apfecker has also suggested that these 1730s slave insurrections, especially the ones in New Jersey and New York, may have had an influence on the young John Woolman. In his first journey into the southern colonies, Woolman makes an observation of his fear that the consequences of slavery, quote, will be grievous to posterity, and he doesn't spell out what he means. And even in Consideration on the Keeping of Negroes, written in 1747, though published somewhat later, he warned that a system that has one group toiling for the luxury and ease of another group will nurture a haughty spirit on one side and a desire for revenge on the other, until, he said, the inhabitants of the land are ripe for great commotion and trouble. And thus luxury and oppression have the seeds of war and desolation in them. Why then does this matter? Scholar Marcus Rediker argues for making the drama of slavery and abolition more complex by putting enslaved Africans at the center of the story as the first and primary abolitionists. And then they win allies from, as he says, metropolitan activists, middle-class saints and proletarian sinners. Instead of seeing blacks as the passive recipients of white abolitionists' concern, we see them as agents actively working for their own emancipation. Thinking about the catalyzing effect of slave revolt similarly decenters the actions and discourse of affluent white Quakers, primarily men in this stage, on both sides of the Atlantic, and potentially reframes the Quaker position as one of support for or response to black agency. That would require friends to adopt a position of somewhat more humility about their our role in the abolition movement than is sometimes the case. I often wonder if we're as interested in the narrative if we're not the protagonists, only the bit players. But it also allows us to participate with more integrity in current trends in scholarship about slavery and abolition that demand attention to all the actors and to the complex actions and reactions that ultimately led to the abolition of the trade and then of the slavery system itself.
Thank you very much, Betsy. Are there comments or questions?
Thanks very much, Betsy. You really filled me in on the huge gap I had in my historical conception of the idea of Quakers in the colonies and slavery. Just a point of information. I think it was the last rebellion in New York City you were referring to. You mentioned that a number of blacks were executed, and so were four or five whites. Could you just elaborate a little bit, why were the whites included in that?
The 1741 New York plot is a very interesting one, and if you're interested, there's a very good book by a scholar named Jill Lepore called New York Burning, and she analyzes the court transcripts and so on. There were the whites who were accused of actually participating in the plotting, One of them was a tavern owner where the conspirators allegedly met. They're lower working class whites who were alleged to have been part of the conspiracy. They're not white, articulate abolitionists.
Am I right in thinking this is about ships, that there were ships that carried dummy guns that were called Quaker guns, or
yes.
else they were Quaker ships?
Yes. Yeah. The dummy gun, actually, I've seen them referred to as Quaker guns,
yeah.
and they were made of wood, and they were supposed to fool the pirates. It's like having an alarm system in your, having a sticker on your door saying you have an alarm system in your house, but you really don't. But it's supposed to convince the burglars that you, any little bit about Quaker standard of truth there. But that's not an issue unique to slave ships. The big risk for slave ships was not pirates, it was insurrection
sure.
on board the ship. It was people coming up from the hold. There was a different set of things. But the guns issue was about piracy and privateers. As far as I can tell from the records I've read, London kept sending out advices telling people they must not ever have guns on their ships. And Quaker ship owners, shipbuilders, and merchants regularly put them on anyway. And I've never seen anybody on either side of the Atlantic disciplined for having guns on their ships. I'd love to know if you ever run across any, particularly those of you who are working in the 18th century. Merchants felt they had no alternative. Maybe if they were in convoy with other ships, they could not have their own guns. But I think certainly the guy whose records I've read, who was slave trading, there were guns, because in his letter to the insurance agent asking for insurance on the ships, they want to know, and he lists out what guns he has on the ship. Quaker captain, by the way.
Well, thank you very much, Betsy, and
You're very
a really
welcome.
Wonderful paper.